Listening Library presents Murder for the Modern Girl by Kendall Culper. Read for you by Valerie Rose Lohman and Max Myers. Chapter 1. Ruby. Chicago, December 31st, 1927.
Golly, good murder took ages.
2 hours. I've been sitting at this horrible excuse for a bar. At this rate, by the time I got out of here, all the best parties would be over.
Across the room, one Francis G. Mather, married, wretched father to five, sat with his arms around two women, wearing enough paint to redecorate Tribune Tower.
I'd watch them drink smoke and toast to the end of 1927.
Good riddance. What a damned awful year.
And now, I was absolutely determined Francis Mather would not see the start of 1928. In front of me sat my own smudgy glass, half full on account I wasn't drinking in the traditional way, but in secret sips and spits into the flask I kept snuggled in my décolletage. Though Papa'd lectured me and my sisters for hours about the dangers of alcohol in all its forms, I didn't have to be the daughter of the Cook County State's attorney to know how colossally idiotic it would be to drink a full glass of smoke. Glittery speakeasies might manage to sneak some legit booze past the jaws of prohibition. But here, in back of the yards, where they hadn't been able to get a drop of the real stuff since 1919, they had to make do with homemade rotgut. Might as well go outside and siphon out some gasoline from the nearest automobile. It'd be quicker and cheaper, and have the same effect. But even if the bartender had offered me a beautiful flute of fizzy golden champagne, chilled and freshly popped, I'd still pass it up. Drinking fiddled with the reception. As Francis Mather launched into another chapter of Horses I Have Known, Bets I Have Made, I had to prop myself up to keep from wilting. I had places to be and people expecting me, and underneath this shabby pink coat, a party frock that was practically required by law to set heads turning. In my pocket, a postage stamp-sized paper sachet of arsenic waited to be dropped into Francis Mather's almost equally poisonous cocktail. It would be so easy to slip it in and walk away. But I had rules. Tips and tricks for a successful murder. 1. Locate the target. Fellows like Francis Mather weren't hard to come by. Good for nothing, drunk, bum, bad husband, worse father, rang through minds from Hyde Park to Uptown more often than the chorus of My Blue Heaven. But as much as I would have liked to take the business end of my hairpin to every deadbeat in the city, the ones who earned a visit from me had to have something truly evil in mind. In this case, 3 trips to the hospital for Mrs. Mather within a year. Illnesses that only seemed to get worse, like terrible rehearsals for something even more awful. Followed by a visit from the life insurance man got people talking, and worrying, and whispering. And that got my attention. 2. Determine appropriate response. Well, did I have to kill them? No, not always.
Ruby, the law can be a powerful weapon for justice,
Papa taught me, and I believed him. But I did find it highly suspicious, not to mention highly annoying, that it seemed to be a hell of a lot more powerful for a certain kind of male person. Still, if the situation called for it, I'd pass tips on to the law. Always anonymously, of course, because as far as anyone knew, I was just a barely 18 girl in the city, glamming around parties, only interested in fast cars and fast boys. As for Mrs. Mather, maybe I could have convinced her to try for a divorce, and maybe the right cop or the right lawyer could have believed her. But Francis Mather had a cousin on the force who was happy to look the other way, and too much resting on a large insurance policy in Mrs. Mather's name. Someday I'd be that right lawyer, and I'd take all the Mrs. Mathers in the world and use the law to positively skewer anyone who tried to hurt them. But golly, I'd only just graduated high school, and law school is years away, and by that time, Mrs. Mather would be dead. I'd take my chances with the arsenic. 3. Wait for the starting pistol. the most important part. How could you possibly be sure a person intended to do real, terrible harm? How could you snip someone out of existence for a crime they had, technically, yet to commit? How could you be sure of someone's mind? But I am always sure. Ever since I was a kid in Nisox, other people's thoughts have bobbed through the air like pretty baubles floating in a stream. I simply had to reach in and pluck them out. Worries and wonders and idle passing fancies, somehow, like a supernatural radio antenna. I could hear them all, and the older I got, the easier it became. I went deeper, under the surface for those bright, flashy fishies, and even all the way down to the mucky bottom, where I could sometimes pry up the deepest, heaviest rocks. I learned to recognize different kinds of minds and what they told me about the person they belonged to. Honest, open people had minds as smooth and clear as a mill pond. People who kept secrets had minds walled up tight, riddled with hidden whirlpools that tried to pull me down. Killers had a particular kind of mind, too. Icy cold, oily slick. At this point, Francis Mathered spent the better part of 2 hours fantasizing about the freedom and money that would come with his wife's death, never mind the 5 mouths relying on him, while also looking forward to a little privacy with his 2 companions. He was a scummy man, a bad father, a worse husband, but not a real murderer. Not yet. And so I sat, waiting, drumming my fingers against the bar and spitting out burning mouthfuls of smoke into my pocket flask.
Another one?
The bartender, and I'd used that word with a whole Christmas basket's worth of generosity, reached for my half-empty glass. The real Ruby Newhouse probably would have snapped at his hand with her purse, flashed a dazzlingly gorgeous smile, and said something like, "The last man who tried to jimmy my dregs lost his whole arm." But I wasn't myself tonight. My red hair was tucked up into a messy black wig and topped with a pitiful pancake hat the color of old putty. I kept my shabby coat bundled over my best deep blue silk dress, and underneath that, my best black satin knickers, the grown-up ones my mother would hang me for if she ever discovered them. With no makeup and a pair of specs nicked from Papa's upstairs office, I was a regular Mrs. Grundy, and 100% guaranteed no one give me more than a fisheye glance. Except for the bartender, annoyed at the sluggish pace of my drinking. "Not done yet," I snapped, snatching my glass away, and, with the patience of a person who worked for tips, he gave me a stiff smile while mentally picturing my gruesome disembowelment.
"And what are we going to do once we get there?"
one of Francis Mather's girls giggled. He leaned in, whispered something that made her snort with laughter. Her thoughts came out mushy and muddled and drowned in smoke, but I could read him loud and clear.
"Tonight or tomorrow. Tonight's better. Get the money by the end of the week. Rat poison. Sneak it into her hot cocoa. They won't find her until the morning. Tonight or tomorrow. Tonight's better."
Starting pistol. And we're off. "Hey, bartender, top her up," I said, and the bartender narrowed his eyes at me, but sloppily filled my glass. Once I had my smoke, I slipped a hand into my pocket for the paper sachet and slid back off my stool, the soles of my scuffy shoes sticking to heavens knew what on the floor. I stumbled a little, cursing, swaying, making my way to an empty table on the other side of the room. Just as I passed Francis Mather's table, my foot caught the ankle of companion number 1, and my glass of liquor went flying, hair to hemline, down the front of companion number 2.
"Watch your bony feet,"
I shouted, while number 2 let out a screech like a cat and jumped up.
"My dress! You ruined my dress! Blame her and those Clydesdale stompers."
"I'll call you a Clydesdale!"
"Girls, girls!"
They both came at me, with Francis Mather laughing fit to bust. The bartender whipped out between us, more worried about what 3 Hellcats could do to his collection of glassware than what we do to each other. So I brayed, "I'm leaving. I'm leaving."
Sample complete. Ready to continue?